Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello, I'm Tom Gilson, and today I'm pleased to bring you the second and concluding part of an interview from a recent event at Discovery Institute's headquarters in Seattle. Discovery Institute's Jonathan Witt interviewed DI Senior Fellow, polymath, and celebrated author David Berlinski about his newest book, Human Nature. Berlinski joined via video link from his apartment in Paris in the shadow of Notre Dame Cathedral. We joined their conversation at the halfway mark.
David, I want to turn now to the opening section of your new book, a section with the foreboding title Violence. And in particular, I want to discuss the second chapter of that section, and it's entitled The Best of Times. And that is an allusion to the opening lines of the famous Charles Dickens novel, A Tale of Two Cities, where, you know, begins, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. And that novel, as you may know, is focused on the French Revolution. It's got some English people, and they get swept up into the French Revolution. And of course, the French Revolution starts out with grand promise and then descends into horror. Now, your essay, The Best of Times, focuses not on the French Revolution, but on the 20th century. And by a certain perspective, if you kind of pick and choose your things to look at, the 20th century is pretty terrific. I mean, if you think about the flowering of new technologies, you think about the significant drop in the rate of extreme poverty globally, the spread of democracy. And as everybody knows, or at least thinks they know, the murder rate in the West has dropped roughly tenfold over the last 500 years. You go back to that, you know, the supposedly God-haunted Middle Ages, and everybody was just, you know, eager to kill another person at the drop of a hat. And now we're a much more peaceful, beneficent group of human beings, which, you know, that would fit in with Christakis's view. But you challenge this at length in your essay, The Best of Times. But let's start with that idea of a trend that, well, at the very least, the murder rate has dropped dramatically. We're much less violent people now than we were in, say, the 1400s. What would you say to that claim?
I would say that it's impossible to maintain that claim while simultaneously regarding the facts of the 20th century and the facts, say, of the 13th century. Oxford, 1321, a young man's town, had a murder rate that has been assessed at roughly 121 per 100,000. That's the standard figure. What do you imagine the murder rate of Jews in Paris in 1941 was? Or at Auschwitz, or in the Gulag, or in China? Any guesses? Well, I can tell you it was much higher than the 121. So why is the figure 1321 Oxford murder rate considered governing with respect to trends? If we are really interested in comparison, there I can name two dozen European cities that had infinitely higher murder rates because all the murder rates were converging to one. Everybody was killed. But there's a second point. Anybody who makes a claim about criminal statistics in the 12th or 13th century has got to repair to the original sources. And certainly, Harari hasn't, Pinker hasn't, and neither have many of the other commentators on the case. Look at the sources, which are very well maintained, but seriously incomplete. You see a tremendous diversity with respect to the murder rates, and the very best historians recognize it. In the 15th and 16th century, murder rates are sky high in one German town. They're very, very much lower in another German town. All in all, there's a considerable amount of uncertainty. But as far as the documents are concerned, modulo that uncertainty, we see murder rates that are quite comparable to murder rates in large American cities like St. Louis or Miami, even more significant. London murder rate, depending on which estimate of the population you believe, is not so very different in the 13th century than the New York murder rate in many periods of time in the 19th and 20th century. They are comparable. What historians often say, what Pinker says is, well, the United States is an outlier. No, it's not. It's Europe that's the outlier. And there's a very good reason that Europe is an outlier after, say, 1950. They were just too exhausted to go back to killing one another. But if you look at Europe between 1900 and 1950, murder rates are infinitely more significant than medieval murder rates. The medievals never had anything in mind comparable to Auschwitz, to Bergen-Belsen, to Sobibor, none of that. So it is with a very, very serious aspect of bad faith that anyone points to the morally enlightened 20th century and claims the decline in murder rate as a point in his or her faith. It's not. And anyone should be serious enough to see that. What has happened is that criminologists look at one set of facts. They look at everything but state violence. And historians look at one set of facts. They look at everything, including state violence. But from the perspective, a large enough perspective to include state violence, murder rates are absolutely shocking in the 20th century. Don't forget, we are dealing with a century that between 1900 and 1950, that's 50 years, saw something like 225 million excess deaths. It's nothing like that that takes place in the medieval 13th century. Nothing like it.
Your title, The Best of Times, as I mentioned, is an allusion to A Tale of Two Cities, which in turn is rooted in, set in French Revolution France.
One point, everybody forgets the second part of that sentence.
Yeah, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times.
No, that's important too.
Yeah, so it is, yeah, and in fact, when I hear the best of times, then immediately that worst of times. And that's a good way to summarize the 20th century. There were these, you know, great technological advances, the advance of democracy, but then you also had 50 million people killed in World War II, 6 million plus Jews at Auschwitz, you know, a few million more in Russia, you know, on and on.
About 60 million is the death toll in World War II. These numbers really count. It's not 6 million, it's 60 million.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's an unbelievably large figure. That's 10 New York cities.
Right, that we just, our mind just kind of balk at it, and it's hard to digest it. But do you see a line, an ideological line, going from the guillotine of the French Revolution to the gulags, the gas chambers of the totalitarian states of early mid 20th century Germany and Soviet Union?
Not only do I see a line, everybody else sees it as well. It's not due to unusual perspicacity on my part. The terror, which began in 1793, lasted 6 or 8 months, and did away with 40,000 victims, which is a bagatelle by 20th century standards, has been an inspiration or an object of fear to totalitarians and those who object to them ever since. I mean, the communists studied, the Russian communists, Soviet communists studied the French Revolution very carefully. They knew about Danton, they knew about Malraux, they knew about Robespierre. They could read the speeches, they saw the effect, and they embraced the terror. There's a direct line. Nobody doubts it, least of all the communists who executed these policies. When Arthur Koestler wrote Darkness at Noon, his great book about Terror of 1937, which destroyed the aristocracy among the revolutionaries, his central character, Rubishov, thinks to himself about Danton's speech when he was fighting for his life. We don't have this speech. We have Bichner's play about Danton's death. But these are the words that come to him through the German automatically. He is in the same position, Danton, who lost his head, with his head his life. He's in the same position of all the revolutionaries as the revolution began to devour its own. Same thing happened in Russia. The same thing happened in China. Germany is an outlier. It's a quite different set of circumstances, but of course the Germans profited from understanding the terror. They had no wish to replicate the Declaration of the Rights of Man, but they understood the terror. And if they had a reproach to be made, it was only that the terror was not thoroughgoing. Not effective. But Germany is an outlier in another respect. The terror was exported. It wasn't in Germany. It was beyond Germany. But if you look at Poland, you look at Ukraine, look at the advance of Russia, you can see that there is an efflorescence which has as its root experiences in the 18th century and in France. I think it's unquestionably so.
Okay, I want to close out. There's so many beautiful passages in this new book, Human Nature. I wanted to see if you could, some of you may not realize that David lives within like a block of Notre Dame Cathedral.
It's right behind me.
The destruction of Notre Dame evoked, you know, this recent fire, you said, evoked an almost universal sense of cultural horror. And you write about it very, very eloquently. And I'm wondering if you'd be willing to read those opening paragraphs from the introduction to the book Human Nature. And then I have a follow-up question for you.
If you don't mind if I wear my glasses.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
I haven't memorized them, unfortunately, but I encourage all my viewers to do just that. It'll only take an hour or so.
I've given him the specific paragraphs. I can't guarantee you he'll stop at the end of that paragraph.
What is it you want me to read?
I think it's the opening, and it goes through.
I have lived within a city block of Notre Dame for the last 20 years. That one?
That's it, yep.
I saw the spire from my bedroom window every morning, and on leaving my apartment, I could walk within a few feet of the cathedral walls, dark with grime on the tail end of the Rue du Cloître, white and sparkling at the head of the street, the stones steam cleaned and scrubbed. On mild winter days, I like to wander through the square Jean the 23rd on the east side of the cathedral. The square was always carefully tended, a fountain and a lovely flower garden at its center. When I needed to get home after the metro had closed and I was too tired to walk, I told taxi drivers, head for Notre Dame. And even if they had never heard of Rue Chanoinesse, my street, they knew how to get there. My father was great friends with Pierre Cochereau, the organist at Notre Dame, and he performed often on the great organ, Water Loft now. My father sometimes let me sit in the organ loft during his recitals. From the loft, the organ seemed to boom and echo. In winter, when there were few tourists, I would go into Notre Dame and light a candle for my friend, Marco Schützenberger. He told me as he was dying that he wished to return as one of the gargoyles. And perhaps he had. No building has ever been more a part of my life. I saw the spire topple slowly at first and then quickly. The police forced me to evacuate to the other side of the Seine. All of Paris was there. I thought of myself as a Parisian, if not by birth, then at least by sentiment. 20 years is a long time. The pompiers were in their glory that night when I was allowed to return home at dawn. They were still there, red-eyed, exhausted, sooty, grim, and proud. The police, too. The enormous plume of smoke had already drifted to the west and the south. Later that day, I saw the front of the cathedral. Its towers were still standing, but its great bells, which I had heard every day, were silent. The fire did a great deal of damage to the cathedral. It could not be contained, and in the end, it burnt itself out. The 1,400-year-old oak timbers that had supported the roof were consumed, and the roof destroyed. President Macron spoke optimistically of rebuilding the cathedral within 5 years, but no one believed him. The structural stability of the North and South Towers is still in doubt. International architects were quick to sketch their plans for the cathedral's restoration, and without exception, they were, if not hideous, then grotesque. One firm proposed putting a swimming pool on the roof. Another, a design in which the roof and spire would be made of glass. The destruction of Notre Dame evoked an almost universal sense of cultural horror. Everyone quite understood that a structure of comparable grandeur lay completely beyond our collective competence.
Beautiful. Thank you, David.
You're so welcome.
I want to play the devil's advocate for a moment. There, then you said it to recreate it. With something comparably grand lies beyond our collective capacity, competence. And you think, okay, we are in a generation whose parents put a man on the moon, a generation that we far surpassed technologically. And yet you're saying that our architects, our politicians, our engineers don't have the capacity to recreate something that grand. Just on the surface, it seems implausible. How could that be?
Well, I don't think it's just a question of architecture, architects, engineers, and technicians. I really did mean to stress collectively, not only can we not build something of that kind of architectural grandeur, but we've lost the capacity to appreciate it, except in the isolated case of structures already built, which we appreciate as if they were museums. That's quite different. Notre Dame was created as the living embodiment of the Christian faith by the entire population of France, notably the population of Paris. Architects, workmen, stonemasons from all over France built that thing over a period of almost 200 years. Main structure was finished in 40 or 50 years, but the embellishments took quite a bit longer. Certainly, we have the technological means to replicate the structure like Notre Dame, even if many of the medieval techniques probably have been lost. We certainly can't replace the oak timbers in the roof because they were already 400 years old in the 12th century. There's just no way to replace that kind of timber. But we could replicate it fairly successfully. My point was otherwise. It is that we have lost the ability to create structures like that. If you look at France, and I live in France, I love France. I'm a devoted member of French society. But the fact remains that this gifted, talented, curious people has not been able to produce one interesting architectural structure since the end of the Second World War. You look at Paris, everything built since 1950 is simply hideous. It's out of taste, it's out of character, it's poorly designed, poorly made, doesn't belong where it is. It's a monument of either vanity or veniality, one of the two. And everybody knows it, everybody has accepted it, and everybody understands we can't do any better. That's why the architecture is so bad, because we can't do better. Even the best, like the pyramid in front of the Louvre, is in its own way grotesque. It doesn't belong there. It's the wrong structure. But the Mitterrand government knew that no French architect could be entrusted with that job, so they found a Chinese architect. Built a remarkable structure, but it's the wrong structure for the wrong place. It instantly reminds everyone of an Apple store. And it was understood to be meretricious when it was first constructed, and now the meretriciousness has been fondly accepted, which is what happens to many, many buildings, unfortunately.
The Center for Science and Culture, by the way, was originally, some of you may remember this, was originally called the Center for the Renewal of Science and Culture. We changed the name, not because we decided we weren't interested in cultural renewal anymore, but because the Center for the Renewal of Science and Culture was a mouthful. We recognized...
Nothing wrong with mouthful.
Yeah, you're okay with, yeah, you have your roots, your sense of history with those long titles, those Victorian book titles. So this
sounds a little Germanic.
Especially long at all. But this brings me back to one of the values of this book, Human Nature. It is, you know, something has been lost from the West. And David Berlinski's latest book, Human Nature, powerfully reminds us of that. It's not always easy medicine. But I do think it is salutary. After all, people are unlikely to recover or renew what they do not even recognize has gone missing. So please join me in thanking Dr. Berlinski for joining us to discuss his new book.
That was Jonathan Witt and David Berlinski discussing Berlinski's latest book, Human Nature. The book is available now from Amazon. Go take a look. Berlinski covers everything from the First World War and the decline of Europe to artificial intelligence and the Darwin design debate. Just search for Berlinski and Human Nature. For ID of the Future, this has been Tom Gilson. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID of the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.